shallow monitoring wells at the water table in ag and urban areas, and then we've sampled deeper domestic and public supply wells to look at the water quality in the drinking water resource. And then finally, the other project we have is measuring domestic well water levels in Douglas County as part of the funding the Rural Water Authority obtained from CWCB as part of a construction fund grant. I have 30 wells up here that we're monitoring. I think it's more like 35 now within the rural areas, and I'll be showing you data from those wells. About 15 of those wells are instrumented with pressure transducers to collect hourly data. And we record the daily minimum, maximum, and mean. Well, we record a value every hour, but the min, max, and mean are posted to the web with results uploaded to the USGS NWIS web data site for public access. So a little bit about groundwater. Maybe you know some of this, maybe you don't. So we'll start with some elementary definitions. Groundwater is the subsurface water that fills the empty pores and cracks beneath the water table. So at some point you move down in the rocks and you reach a water table, and the water below that is groundwater as opposed to surface water that's in the stream. So there's porosity between those rocks, and that porosity fills with water. You know, some of the words and terms you might hear are confined versus unconfined conditions. Unconfined are water table conditions where you have a free water surface that moves up and down. A confined aquifer is one that occurs at depth. Here we have a confined, if this is a sandstone at depth, like we have in the Denver Basin, it's overlain by other rock units, and there is pressure from that overlying column of water and rock, and so you have a confined aquifer. And when you drill a well into that, it might flow at the surface and be artesian. And then that's called a flowing well. Or if the head in the well rises above the top of the aquifer, it's confined. And if the head in the well is below the top of the aquifer, it's unconfined. So those are kind of some of the basic definitions of artesian and confined you might be interested in. So how do we evaluate aquifers? Because you can't see them. We use surface water observations, and we use wells. So we measure water levels in wells. We might test the aquifer by doing a pump test. We can sample the water quality, find out the age of the water, different parameters that might tell us where that water came from. So that's another clue. And then we take that data, we map it up, and we interpret the data. Sometimes we build computer simulations for understanding and prediction. So we've done most of all those things with some of the Denver Basin data. I wanted to say a few words about types of wells. We have different types of wells. Might have an observation or a monitoring well. This is one of our NACWA wells out in near the South Platte. You have domestic wells. Here's a Denver Basin domestic well. You might have an irrigation well, like here on the South Platte. This is a large public supply well in the Tampa Bay area. So if we're going to measure water levels in these wells, it's important to know what type of well it is. A monitoring well is not going to be pumped on a regular basis. All these other wells would be pumped at some point. And so when you measure a water level, you need to know if it's been pumping or not. Or you need a record that shows you the pumping so that you can see where you are in the pumping cycle of that well and what does the water level represent that you're measuring. And so then we take from water level data, so we measure the depth to water in a well, and we get an elevation, right? And we can take those elevations, plot them on a map spatially, and then we can contour lines of equal elevation, and we develop a flow net that tells us which way groundwater is flowing. Because it's just like a weather map. If you see the high pressure and the low pressure on a weather map, groundwater is the same way. It's going to flow from higher altitude or higher head to lower altitude or lower head. So those are how we figure out which way the groundwater is flowing. Oh, and then this was a fun one. I had to put in my groundwater flow equation because I wasn't supposed to give a technical talk. So when we do computer models, what we do is we take the aquifer unit and we divide it up into blocks, basically, where we're going to calculate the head for each cell, okay? And then what we're going to do is we're going to calculate that head, and we're going to compare that head to what we measured in a well. And we're going to iterate on the properties of the aquifer, the transmissivity and the storage, and other inputs to the system until we get a match between what we've measured and what we're calculating. So that's what a groundwater flow model does, is we build the geometry of the aquifer system, and we put hydraulic connectivity, transmissivity values in, and then we run it through a model to calculate the head. And we compare that to what we see. So that's kind of the groundwater primer. The Denver Basin, you've probably seen this map before. I saw it on the Douglas County website today. This is out of the Colorado Geological Survey Groundwater Atlas. Here we are down in Castle Rock on the south and west side of the basin. And the Denver Basin is about 7,000 square miles along the Front Range up north to Greeley, out east toward Lyman, and then down to the south wraps around east of Colorado Springs. So we have different land uses. This is a structural basin. The geology is we have the uplift of the Front Range Mountains and then a syncline out to the east, filled with sediments, sand and gravels, and clay stones that form the aquifers and confining units. Land use, these colors don't show up too great, but a lot of rangeland over the basin, irrigated agriculture out along the South Platte, non-irrigated ag out in the northern part of the basin. The gray on this map are the urban areas, green are forested areas, and the red triangles are the municipal wells that are pumping from the Denver Basin aquifers. So we've identified three primary areas. There's a northern area up north of Denver, the South Metro area where we're in right now, and then down around Monument is another area of concentrated municipal pumping from the Denver Basin. And you can see these are kind of outside the areas that are mapped as urban because of the growth that has occurred. The growth is occurring faster than the mapping can keep up with the land use mapping. So what are the issues in the Denver Basin? I think we'd all like to know what are the long-term effects as the pumping continues. What are the effects on water levels? Is it depleting stream flow, and is it depleting storage in the aquifer? Technically, the variation of aquifer properties is an important aspect of modeling and understanding. Also, to get a better number for the estimates of recharge to the system, and then how is it moving down, up or down, vertically through the system? And then are we adequately monitoring the system so that we can understand it, the water levels, the stream flow, and the pumping? Here's another view of the aquifer system, looking at the specific aquifers. In map view, again, here we have the Denver Basin. The youngest rocks occur in the middle of the basin, the Dawson, where we are here. Here's the Dawson up near the Palmer Divide, because of this synclinal bowl-shaped structure, geologic structure. So from the bottom to the top, we have the major aquifers are the Laramie Fox Hills, the Arapaho, the Denver, and the Dawson. And the Dawson and the Arapaho are divided into an upper and lower unit in some parts of the basin. But because of this bowl shape, we get the oldest rocks around the edge. Here are the oldest rocks outcropping on the outside edges, and then the youngest rocks are in the middle. And overlying all these bedrock formations are alluvial sand and gravel channels that occur along the streams and tributaries of the South Platte River. Also down Black Squirrel Basin, and this is the Nussbaum Alluvium and Big Sandy. And these parts of the system are much more permeable than the bedrock and also contain large quantities of groundwater. Okay, I have to keep the mic closer, sorry. I usually yell a lot, so I'm like trying not to yell into the mic. So for the model, what we did was we represented each of those layers in the model. Each aquifer is in blue, and then the intervening zones are the confining units, and those are primarily claystone, and so those are also represented in the modeling that we did. And I guess one caveat that the model assumes things are relatively homogeneous, that a sandstone is a sandstone and there's no clay, and so we all know that's not true, so this is a simplification of the system. So just want to remind everybody of that. We did map the sand, silt sand thickness for each of the aquifer layers based on geophysical logs that were available. And that data was actually tabulated by the state engineer's office over the years as well water wells were drilled. And this is a map showing the silt sand thickness for the Arapaho aquifer. And you can see this dark colors are the thickest sands, up to 400 or 500 feet thick of sandstone on the west side of the basin. If any of you have seen Bob Reynolds speak, he talks about the Wildcat Mountain fan, and we essentially have mapped that feature in the subsurface here. So we have very coarse-grained, thick deposits of sand on the west central side of the basin, which fine outward towards the edges of the basin as these sediments were shed off of the Front Range as the mountains rose and the basin subsided. So we've incorporated all those things into our modeling in terms of the spatial distribution of the sands. The boundary conditions. Boundary conditions are what are the inputs and outputs to a groundwater system or any kind of a model. So our inputs are precipitation, recharge from precipitation, recharge from irrigation, and streams. And then we have outflow from two streams, to evapotranspiration, and then to pumping. Here you can see in Castlewood Canyon, if you walk through there, you can see a lot of the seeps and springs coming out into Cherry Creek there. It's a good example of that outflow. So for the recharge, precipitation recharge, we looked at climate data from the 1930s through 2003, which is what our modeling period, and mapped out wet and dry periods. The dry periods are in brown. The wet periods are in blue here. In general, of course, we have a long-term average annual precipitation of about 15 inches per year for all the weather stations over the Denver Basin, so very semi-arid, dry climate, as most of you probably already know. We do see a spatial pattern where the highest precipitation occurs. You get an orographic effect along the Palmer Divide, and so you get greater precipitation along that topographic high from Castle Rock out to Kiowa and out in that area. So Monument, if you've ever driven over Monument Hill in a snowstorm, you'll get it. So higher, more precipitation at higher elevation. So more recharge, more precipitation recharge. Here's a map of the simulated recharge that we came up with over the basin. This is the net recharge, so we took all of the inflows from recharge minus the evapotranspiration from the water table. And so we came up with estimates of precipitation recharge ranging from 1 to 7% of precipitation that makes it to the water table. So that's about half an inch per year over most of this area in gray is about a half inch per year of precipitation. And then there are some areas in yellows and reds where it's actually negative. We have more evaporation than we do precipitation, so there is no net recharge. We get greater recharge over the alluvial aquifers because they're more permeable, and then, of course, out here in these irrigated acres along the South Platte River. For the pumping, we looked at estimates of pumping by tabulating the numbers of wells and their depths and their locations and applying factors that have been used before because there's no measured pumping in the basin. So we used some previously developed methods. This is what we came up with. We estimated pumping from 1880 through 2003. The yellow line is pumping from the alluvial aquifers along the channel. So those are sand and gravel aquifers. And most of the water, there is more water being pumped from the alluvial system than from the bedrock system. It's about 187 cubic feet per second. By 2003. And for the bedrock, we see an increase. Another interesting thing about this alluvial pumping is that you see a big jump in the 1950s, 60s, until the regulations were implemented in 1969, controlling the pumping out of the alluvial aquifers, and then you kind of see a more gradual increase. For the Denver Basin bedrock aquifers, this is in the blue line, about 118 cubic feet per second by 2003. And again, you see more of just a gradual and continual increase in the pumping, pretty steady increase in the pumping. And this is basin-wide, so this is for the whole basin. And so then we get a total of about 305 cubic feet per second. And so we've divided this time up into increments for our modeling. So it's a transient, runs through time, our simulations. And this is just another view of the total pumping in 2003. It's how it's broken out. About 62% of the pumping was from the alluvial aquifer, that 187. And then the other almost 40% is from the bedrock aquifers, with most of that coming from the Arapaho in blue and the Denver in this purpley-red color, and then lesser pumping from the Dawson and the Laramie Fox Hills. And if we look at that, break those out separately for just the alluvial aquifer, and look at its water use, 90% of the pumping from the alluvial aquifer is to irrigation of crops. So mostly along, because we have that piece of the South Platte up on the north end of the basin. So a lot of that is irrigation pumping. For the bedrock aquifers, about 40% of the pumping is for municipal use, and about 28% of the pumping is for domestic use. So that would be domestic wells, rural water users, self-supplied groundwater, versus the municipal pumping. And then we also broke out commercial, industrial, 12%, and irrigation. So the bedrock aquifers are not as heavily used for irrigation, obviously. They don't produce enough water to irrigate crops. So most of the use of the bedrock aquifers is municipal and domestic. Looking at the spatial distribution, the municipal wells, this is the same well plot I showed you earlier where they were all in red, but now I've got them color-coded by aquifer so that you can see the spatial distribution. So when you count the number of wells, about 2% are municipal, about 1,000 municipal wells out of 55,000 wells that were in our analysis, and they represent 43% of the yield pumping. And they're mostly located in these three areas I indicated before, the northern area, the South Denver metro area, and the monument area. We see Laramie Fox Hills in green, Arapaho in blue along the South Platte River to the north. South metro area has mostly Arapaho wells, but also a lot of Denver and Dawson wells. And then down to the south, we have Denver and Arapaho are the primary aquifers used for municipal pumping. The domestic wells, we also plotted up. So those 95% of the wells in the bedrock are are domestic wells. That's 46,000 wells, 27% of the yield out of the bedrock. And this is domestic use. It's generally more shallow than the municipal use, but it's very widespread all over the basin. Everybody's using that. There's no surface water out here, especially in this northeastern part of the basin. And so I've color-coded those as well. Yellow is the Dawson, red is the Denver, blue the Arapaho, green the Laramie Fox Hills. And you see that the well locations do coincide pretty nicely with the outcrop patterns of those different aquifers. So people are generally drilling wells into the first available water is what that tells us, right? Okay, so some of the modeling results. I'll go through, show you some of the head calculations, what groundwater flow directions are indicated from those heads, look at the extent of confined conditions and how that's changed, and look at the water budget changes through time on a regional basis. I'm just going to show the Denver and the Arapaho aquifers. So this is a pre-development water table map that we generated with our model. And it shows the Denver aquifer, so that's pre-development, pre-1880. And the red areas are the areas of the aquifer that are unconfined because the aquifer is near the land surface. And the gray area is the part of the aquifer that is confined because it's buried beneath the other aquifers. And then the arrows indicate the groundwater flow directions. So we have regional flow away from the topographic high of Palmer Divide to the north, out toward the South Platte and its tributaries, and also flow down toward Monument Creek, discharge this way, and down toward Black Squirrel Creek. So that's the pre-development estimate. And then here's the 2003 result, where now the flow, instead of all heading off toward the Platte, we have, oops, this is missing its arrows, but you can, these are the equipotentials, so it's perpendicular to that. So now we have flow toward these pumping wells. The red municipal wells are plotted on here in the South Metro area and then in the Monument area as well. And these purple areas are locations where the conditions have converted from confined aquifer to unconfined aquifer because we've lowered the head and now the aquifer is unconfined. So these are what we're predicting, is that there's a pretty substantial area of converting to unconfined conditions in the north and then down in the monument area as well. For the Arapaho, again, this is the pre-development water table calculated from the model. You can see there's, here's the South Platte coming through here. No, yeah, no, it's up here. So we have, oh, no, that's Clear Creek. That's the South Platte. Yeah, right there. And there's a kind of a low in the water table here. So we've got flow toward that area, toward the South Platte to the north. Again, radial flow out to the edges. And this unit is mostly confined. It has a very small outcrop area compared to the Denver. So the blue is the unconfined, and the gray, again, is the confined area. And then the difference, this is at the end of the simulation in 2003, and we can see this area where drawdown is, from pre-development, the drawdown is about 100 feet in this whole area, 500 feet in the bright red area. These are the Arapaho municipal wells. You can see many cones of depression down to the south in the monument area. But what's interesting is that this is that Wildcat Mountain fan area where we have the big, thick sandstones with a nice extent and all the municipal wells in there. In the simulations are basically forming a large cone of depression that's sort of regional in scale. And then down to the south in the monument area where we don't have those thick sandstones, it's finer grain materials. We get smaller, more isolated cones of depression from the pumping, but they are steeper because it's finer grain material. So they might be deeper drawdown cones, but less extent. So they don't extend out as far down to the south. So, and so what this has done is the pumping from the Arapaho, between the Arapaho and the Laramie Fox Hills beneath it is a very thick confining unit that's almost 500 feet thick, so we don't see much vertical interaction between those units. This is the downward flow between each unit. So this is the downward flow from the upper Dawson to the Dawson confining and the Dawson confining to the lower Dawson, et cetera, going from the top of the aquifer system to the bottom. So we see very little downward flow from the lower Arapaho to the Laramie confining unit. But we see a lot of downward flow within the Denver-Arapaho sequence here, indicating that those parts of the basin are more well connected than other parts of the basin in a vertical sense. So the numbers in the top clear boxes are the pre-development drawdown. So it was a natural downward gradient pre-development conditions. You know, rain's on the top and water moves down. But the pumping from the Arapaho has tripled and in some cases tenfold increase in downward flow or downward flow potential between the aquifers. So there's been a change in the inner aquifer flow in a downward direction. And the water budget has always also changed. So here's the water budget where we look at what's flowing in minus what's flowing out. So we have an inflow and an outflow. This is pre-development. So all the sources of inflow are recharge, what we talked about already. And then it flows out to the alluvial aquifer and out to surface water under pre-development conditions. This is for the bedrock aquifers. And then we see under developed conditions in 2003, we have inflow from recharge again. But we have inflow coming from storage, the water that's been stored in the rocks for a very long time. And then we have outflow to the alluvial aquifer, which is decreased, outflow to surface water, which is decreased, and then outflow to wells, which is now about 80% of the outflow from the basin. So we're pumping, and the recharge is not keeping up with the pumping, so we're taking water from storage is the story here. And here's a plot of the change in storage through time. This is the cumulative storage, cumulative change in bedrock storage in thousands of acre feet. So we have the blue line, which is the bedrock, and that declines substantially after the 1980s as we continue to pump from the bedrock aquifers. And these lines up here, the red or the black and the white, are for... It's kind of a zonal analysis that spatially the black line is that south metro area and the white line is the whole rest of the basin. And this is total for all the aquifers. So about half of the storage removal that is occurring in that South Metro area for all aquifers. And then the yellow line is the alluvial aquifer. And so we see storage in the alluvial aquifer. It declines during these dry years, these brown periods. We take water out of storage as we pump from the alluvial aquifer, and then it was pretty steady. And then during these wet years of the 1990s, we actually had a return to storage in the alluvial aquifer. And then here at the end of the simulation, you see the 2002 drought is this dry period, and we get another decrease in the alluvial aquifer storage. And you kind of see a downtick in the bedrock storage. The curve steepens as the drought kicks in. And then, let's see, one more little piece down here, which is, this is the, it's hard to read, sorry, the aquifer breakout for the storage at this point down here in 2003. About 40, almost 50% of that storage depletion is coming from the Denver, where we saw that change from confined conditions to unconfined conditions. Only a little bit of change in storage from the Arapaho, and then the rest is coming from the Laramie Fox Hills and the Dawson. So this graph kind of puts together a lot of things in one place and looks rather complicated. So again, we've got to see if I can explain it easily. This is the precip graph again. You see underneath, here's our long-term average of 15 inches per year. It's kind of underlying this. And then here's our pumping curve from the bedrock as pumping continues to increase over time to 2003. It starts at 1880. And then the green line up here, this is the recharge that we've applied, precipitation recharge and irrigation recharge, and you can see it goes up and down and goes down with respect in a dry period here, goes up through this wet period of the 1990s. And then the red line is the resulting storage depletion from the bedrock aquifers, and so you can see that the storage is responding not only to the increase in pumping, but also to the change in recharge. So it's responding more to the pumping than it is the change in recharge, but there is an influence of drought conditions on the near surface parts of the basin. And then I just have one slide with some groundwater quality results from our NACWA sampling. This is a graph showing apparent groundwater age. We analyze samples for indicators of groundwater age, such as CFCs, carbon-14, and some other parameters. And I've plotted the age here versus the depth of the well. So this is the depth of the midpoint of the well beneath the land surface. And so what we see is that in our shallow water table monitoring wells, we get young water. Less, and by young, I mean less, it's recharged since 1953. Tritium, bomb tritium from nuclear weapons testing in the 50s is the definition of young water. If you see that young water in your well, or if you see tritium in a well, you know it's a young water. Sorry, I said it backwards. So we see young waters that are tritium rich in the shallow parts of the system. We also see detections of nitrate, volatile organic compounds, and pesticides at the water table. And then we see a lot of wells that are deeper, so more than 250 feet deep at various depths down to 800 feet that are tritium dead. So they are old waters. These were recharged prior to 1953, and the carbon-14 dates indicate ranges from up to 40,000 years old to the edge of the carbon-14 range. And those have no detections of nitrate or VOCs or pesticides. Those are very pure, pristine, old waters. And then we see these samples that kind of plot in the middle. These triangles are all domestic wells, and these are monitoring wells up here, and these are monitoring wells over here as well. But these are mixtures of young and old water. And so we see this, and they'll have detections of nitrate, and we see that in areas that are heavily pumped. There's mixing of water, pulling younger water down into deeper zones. So that's some of the water quality is telling us there's some downward movement within the aquifer systems. Okay, so let's move to the water level monitoring we've been doing in rural Douglas County. This is a map of Douglas County. The gray areas are the non-rural areas, so those are not under the jurisdiction of the Rural Water Authority. And then I've also plotted the water supply zones on here. Thank you, Tim. I see you in the audience. And these are the water supply zones that Douglas County has implemented for their water supply plans. And then the dots are the locations of the wells. Again, blue are Arapaho. We only have a couple of Arapaho wells. They're hard to come by. And then we have quite a few in the upper and lower Dawson, some Denver wells, and a couple of Laramie Fox Hills wells. So I'm going to zoom in on some of these and show you the results we have so far and talk about measuring water levels. So this is Upper Dawson Well 1 down here. I didn't put the cities on here. That would have helped the towns. I don't have much for reference there. Anyway, okay, so up on the top on each of these are hand-measured water levels where we've opened the well and we've put a tape down and we've measured the depth to water. And then on the bottom are the transducer results where we have installed a pressure transducer in the well and we're collecting hourly water level data. So, and for each of these, we see a daily max, a daily min, which are most of these little squigglies, and then a mean. And then the red dots on here are the measured values that we see up here put with the other data so that we can see where our measured values are with respect to the transducer results. So for the minimum values, what you see is a lot of up and down. So that's every time the pump comes on at this domestic well, the water level drops, right? And then it goes off and the water level comes back up. So there's a lot of drawdown just within the well. But what we are interested in is the long-term effect. What does the long-term mean result? And where is the point that water level returns to when the pump is turned off? And is that declining over time? So these measurements started in September last year. We're now here in April was the last measurement. And so we've seen an increase because we've gone from we see some decrease in the fall, and then we see a return to static conditions in the winter. These hand measurements show that very more clearly. It's on a different scale. So you can see here was the winter measurement. Oh, no, that was early summer, last May, June, and then you see a decline in the water levels over the summer when we do more watering, irrigation of lawns and so forth, more water use in the summer, and then the water level recovers over the winter back to some static level. So we see that pattern, and so this is for the Dawson, and we see that pattern for several wells. Here's another one up to the north, and it has a similar pattern, and we don't know where we were up here, so we can't say if we've actually returned to that same static or not. We see a steeper recovery curve and maybe a steeper drawdown up to the north as we approach this area of a lot of more pumping. So we'll see if that bears out. Here's a Denver well. Again, see the same pattern, low well water levels in the fall, late summer, fall, recovery in the spring, or in the winter, sorry. I'm going to confuse everyone if I don't say it right. And then here's the long-term water level. And this is near the edge of the basin over here. So you can see how important it is actually to collect this hourly data and then have confirming data points, because you could measure a water level down here and get, and then one up here, and then you would see a very different drawdown curve. So it's really important to have this long-term and frequent water level data. You have a question? You know, let's see. Here we have Plum Creek. This is Perry Pines. Rhett's here. He's the guy doing all the work. So that's Perry Pines. It's a subdivision. Okay, where's Castle Rock on here? West of Larkspur. Sorry, I didn't get the towns on here. That would have been helpful. Here's another one up farther north toward the county line. This is another Denver well. And you see very little change, actually, in the long-term water level so far. I mean, this is only from December through the spring. If you look from May, it's recovered and then declined again. And so one would say, oh, there's a problem here. It's really declining. It's gone down from 55.20 to Well, it's only declined. That's a scale issue. That's only 3 or 4 feet. But when you look at where the red dots are on the long term, they would indicate a decline, but it's actually because the pump was on when we were out there. So it's good to have, again, this long-term transducer data. No. The question was, do we have any monitoring wells that are not pumped that we are using for water level data? And I think there is, actually, there's one well out at the Kiowa Fairgrounds that was drilled, the Kiowa core hole, and it's completed in the Denver, and that is not pumped. And that's been a good long-term record. I think that well shows about, at last count, about 5 feet of decline per year. So kind of, you know, not a lot of decline, but some decline over time that it's been out there. And the state monitors the water levels in that well, actually. Here's another up to the north, right near the county line, just south of C-470. And again, a steeper recovery curve, and then a little bit steeper of a drawdown. And we have a longer record on this well of seasonal highs and lows. And so this is what we really need to be, you know, collecting this long-term data is so important. So we see the seasonal high and the seasonal low, but each year the seasonal high gets a little bit lower. And in this area, this is in the Denver, and we're seeing declines on order for 4 to 5 feet per year in the Denver. We don't have any transducers in the Arapaho for this study because the depths to water are so great. We can't get all the cabling down there. So this is showing the Division of Water Resources where they're monitoring in the Arapaho. These are their wells. And this is a figure out of my report where I've shown the observed versus the simulated water level for each of those wells. And our model's not doing very good here. It's predicting much higher water level than we're observing. So, but there are some declines. You can see here some of these declines in the South Metro area on the order 25 to 35 feet per year has been what's been reported. But again, it's this issue of we only have, a water level, one water level at a point in time. So we don't always know where that well is in its pumping cycle either. So, again, emphasizing the importance of really long-term data and frequent data collection. For the Laramie Fox Hills, our model did much better at predicting water levels in the Laramie Fox Hills than in the Arapaho. We actually have very good correspondence and different parts of the basin. I saw some of these are, let's see, that's about 20 feet over. I think I was calculating rates of 10 to 15 feet per year in the Laramie Fox Hills in some of these areas of water level decline. So the water levels are declining in some areas. We also saw areas where there was water level rise on the west side of the basin down around the Air Force Academy where there's more irrigation going on. There's some actual areas where you get recharge when these aquifers are near the land surface and water levels have risen. So there's different things going on in different parts of the basin. It's hard to say one size fits all, I think, for everything. So some conclusions, and then maybe we'll have time for questions. Changes to the heads and the flow directions. We observe seasonal drawdown and recovery with a simulated long-term drawdown in all the bedrock aquifers. The flow is redirected toward pumping centers compared to the pre-development or undeveloped conditions. We do see coalescing drawdown cones simulated in the South Metro area where the sandstones are continuous and thick. And we see isolated drawdown cones in areas in the monument area where there is a lower percent sandstone. Changes to the water budget. We've seen reduced discharge from the bedrock aquifers to the alluvial aquifer and to streams. And storage depletion is accentuated by drought and continued increases in pumping. We also see increased downward interaquifer flow within the Denver and Arapaho aquifers in that South Metro area, in that sandstone that's down there, and that's supported by the water quality data. So, some implications. We've developed this new model. It's useful for looking at things on at a regional scale. We need to work on drilling down to some local issues. These results, it's a conceptual model that supports a finite resource that's limited by the available recharge, and pumping and downward flow can potentially affect water quality. And additional monitoring of the heads and the discharges, the pumping and stream flow are really needed for continued and future assessments. So with that, I'll open up to questions. What do you want to do? I did pretty good. I thought I'd run over.
Well, thank you for a very interesting display. And I wonder if there's somewhere we can get these charts. Are they published?
Yes, I'm sorry, I should have said that. It's all published in a report. Let me grab it. If you want to sign up out front or something, I can send some of these out. I have some hard copies, and then they're available on our website. If you want to send me an email, here's my email address. I should have put that website up here. I'm sorry. So... but it's a PDF file online.
Could you go back to your conclusions, please?
Okay.
On the groundwater flow redirected toward pumping centers, is that all pumping centers or just where they're centered, like in Denver? Or, you know, explain that a little bit.
Okay.
Then I have one other question.
Let me go back up to the pumping map. Let's see. So the blue triangles are municipal wells, and this area of drawdown, this is the South Metro area, here's the northern area, here's the monument area. What I mean by that is that groundwater flow, which was more northerly, is now being directed more in toward those areas that
okay.
are being pumped.
So when you say the groundwater flow, in each aquifer or?
Yes.
Okay. All right, that makes sense. And if you go back to the conclusions again, I have another question I think that kind of
okay.
ties into that one. Sorry, I'm not good at
no
remembering.
Problem. Okay.
The last one, last bullet, the increased downward inner aquifer flow, especially in the Denver and the Arapahoe aquifers.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of just what you alluded to.
Well,
so
that's... When I say flow toward a pumping center, that's the horizontal component, and inner aquifer flow is the downward component.
Okay, so in the downwards, are you saying
so
that?
We've increased the downward flow as well because a majority of the pumping is coming out of that lowest aquifer, which is the lower Arapahoe.
Okay, so in the past, historically, we've been told that these aquifers, they're impermeable between the
mm-hmm.
two of them. So then what you're saying is that's not true.
I think there's connections the way we have the layers set up in our model. The Denver aquifer and the Arapahoe aquifer are, okay, back up. That Wild Cat Mountain fan that I showed, that big area of sandstone, it's divided in our model between the Denver and the Arapahoe. So there is flow between those layers, and the Denver confining unit is generally less than 50 feet thick. So on a regional basis, it's showing flow between those layers.
USGS put out a report about 20 years ago for the Denver Basin predicting declines in water levels. How does your work compare with that work that was done 20 years ago?
Well, we've kind of joked, it's like, well, we either didn't need to do it again or because it's very similar. Our work is, this model is more detailed than that model was. It only had 4 layers, and we have 12. So we've done additional vertical dividing, discretization of the model. The water budgets were relatively similar. Ours had more recharge from irrigation because there was no irrigation recharge included in previous models. And we also did, I think we improved upon spatially estimating the extents of the sands and incorporating that into our model results.
So are you saying the report 20 years ago is not worth reading and again, using anymore? Or?
I think it has some good conclusions. I think our model might be more accurate, if you will, whatever that's worth.
Well, it just depends on what cubic space you use for your module model.
Yeah.
So.
But actually, the overall water budget numbers were very similar of what we came up with versus the previous model, and some of the conclusions were similar.
Another question?
Yeah. Can you estimate, in your opinion, what the usable lifespan of the Dawson and the Arapaho aquifers are?
I was waiting for that question. Yeah. I should have started with it.
The Museum of Natural History had a pretty scary one.
Yeah. No, we're not that brave in terms of estimating a life. You know, we've run the model out in a predictive mode out 50 years, and because it's a model, cells will go dry in a model because of the numerical methods it's using. But if the water levels are low in those parts of the aquifer, that might be an indication that those are places where problems could occur first. And that, I think, around the monument area was one area that kept going dry in our model runs. So, you know, it's finer grain materials there rather than in the thick sandstone areas. There's also some areas on the northern end of the Dawson up around Parker, the Franktown area, a lot of drawdown up in that area. So, you know, I think the areas that are displaying the most drawdown in the model are the areas that, you know, could expect problems first. But we haven't been so brave as to predict the day it will all go dry. I'm not sure that day will ever come for the whole basin, right? So.
Yes, could you tell me how much of the permeability of the zones can be attributed to the depletion of the water and the recovery rate?
Let's see. I'm not sure how to answer.
When you deplete the zones, when you draw the water down, how much permeability do you lose in that zone as the water is trying to recover?
Well, it would depend on the local conditions. As it converts from confined to unconfined, you'll take more water out of storage. Not sure if I'm answering your question. Because when you take off the pressure head and you're draining the aquifer, you get more water out of storage. More water is coming from storage. I'm sorry, I have to use the microphone. I can't hear you. because of compression? Okay. Well, we were talking about that earlier today. In theory, you shouldn't see as much of that in the Denver Basin because it's more consolidated rock versus some place like the Central Valley where you have unconsolidated sediments, and as those dewater, they compact. Is that what you mean? Okay. I haven't heard of any instances of that in the Denver Basin, but I may not know about it. So.
We live off of Toma Road. Recently, we discovered our well water level is sitting at about 5,300 MSL and hasn't changed in 12 or 13 years. Our neighbor next door is only getting about 6 gallons per minute, while we're getting about 75 gallons per minute, and that's good news for us. What's occurring down at 550 feet that would cause that disparity?
Could be a number of things. I don't know if they're completed in the same intervals. There could be problems with the well that's not producing in terms of iron bacteria. If it's a steel well, plugging the screen, there could be issues like that. I don't know. You know, you really have to maybe scope it with a camera to see the condition of the well. Some of those problems. And that's another problem with water level data. We want to pick wells that are relatively new and not, you know, not have issues like that, because you can get plugging of the screen, which would then not allow water into the well, and then you're measuring a water level that's lower than what you would see in the aquifer. So you might be thinking you have a huge drawdown well going dry problem when really it's the well construction.
Doesn't that get into the issue of whether the zones are actually connected in the shallow wells in our at our homes?
Yes.
In other words, there's a word for that, non-something and... Yeah, non-tributary.
Oh, yeah.
I think that the shallow wells, I've been told the shallow wells that we have, say, in Ponderosa Hills are discontinuous. They're not connected. So in his case, he could be in one zone, in one finger, and his neighbor could be in a different finger.
That's also possible.
Mm-hmm. Whereas what you're talking about are the deeper aquifers that are connected.
There are places where they are, yes.
Yeah.
And places where they are not.
One more question.
Okay. My email address. I wonder if they have Wi-Fi here I could connect to it. Better not try it.
Yes. We have a well in Lower Dawson, and within a mile and a half there are five Castle Rock wells. Would you expect drain down from the Lower Dawson down to those deep wells, which I understand are 2,400 feet down?
I don't know what's causing that. Is it me? I probably not in that case. I mean, we see most of that vertical movement I was talking about is in the South Metro area between the Denver and the Arapahoe, not between the Dawson as much. The Dawson is a little more isolated, and then the Laramie Fox Hills beneath it is as well. So I don't know. We'd have to look at the geometry of your well and how deep it is and how deep those other wells are.